Hi, I'm Rabbi Andrew Goodman, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist, and I Beat Shazam.
Hey, Rabbi.
Wow, that's amazing. So I thought that when I stopped with school that I, you know, didn't necessarily have to study for each episode anymore. But I think that I might need a little support.
Okay. I mean, I think we both support each other. I think we make a really good team.
Absolutely. But sometimes we need to look beyond our friends for support, right? Like sometimes there might even need institutional support. But I don't know if that would apply to me because I'm done with school. Do you think that there might be anybody that might be able to help me?
I think you have made some really incredible connections with some really wonderful people who would love nothing more than to support you, support me, and support this project.
Say, someone who might be even willing to come back to be on this episode?
Wait, a repeat guest? How exciting!
Surprise! Believe, considering the fact that, you know, it feels like time has just been going by and going by and going by, but we are actually beginning a new book today. I know that shouldn't come as a surprise if you listened last week. We ended one, but this week we're starting one because, you know, finals week. So, of course, we probably should start something new in the middle of ending something at the same time. Wow, that's meta, but it'll come back to us later. I am so excited to say that we did want to both kind of start and end something at the same time. And so for this penultimate podcast episode, we were really, really excited to welcome back our friend and our, as we like to say, backstage advisor, somebody who really helped get this podcast off the ground. And I would argue also has helped both me and Gabe get through HUC. And we miss not seeing him every day, but we love the fact that he's here today. And so we're thrilled to welcome back Rabbi Andrew Goodman. Rabbi Andrew A. Goodman is Director of Student Support at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, HUCJIR. Rabbi Goodman focuses his work supporting all HUC students to persist and thrive in their programs and develop the necessary scaffolding to best serve as the next generation of Jewish professional leadership for North American Jewry and beyond after degree completion. Wait a minute, I just completed my degree. Gabe just got a master's in sacred music. Like, this is exciting. We are ready for your support as we continue beyond HUC. So now we know we can call. Rabbi Goodman came to the College Institute with a breadth of experiences and collegial networks nationwide. He studied psychology and English at the University of Michigan with extensive coursework toward a teaching certificate and served as a youth group advisor and program director for Temple Beth Emmet in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Go Blue! Upon graduation, Rabbi Goodman studied in HUCJIR's rabbinical program in New York, where he earned his Master's of Arts in Hebrew Literature and rabbinical ordination in 2008, which, just so anybody was keeping track, is when I got my Bachelor of the Arts in Psychology and Judaic Studies, and Gabe, nobody wants to know what you were doing then. During his time at HUCJIR, Rabbi Goodman's primary focus was pastoral counseling, spending 2 years working with homebound seniors in New York City and 3 summers as a chaplain candidate for the United States Navy Chaplain Corps. Following his ordination, Rabbi Goodman served as the rabbi of Temple Beth Israel in Plattsburgh, New York. In addition to his congregational duties, he worked as adjunct professor at SUNY Plattsburgh, which is really cool, part of the chaplaincy teams at both the local hospital and the prison, and vice president of the Interfaith Council of Plattsburgh and Clinton County. In 2011, Rabbi Goodman joined the Office of the Chaplaincy at the University of Richmond in Richmond, Virginia, as their first director of Jewish life and campus rabbi, and later was appointed as the first director of religious social responsibility. By the way, both places he greatly influenced and motivated my friend and family member, Dana Urban. And
he beat Shazam!
Yeah. Rabbi Andrew Goodman, we're so excited to welcome you to the show. Welcome back to the podcast that you helped promote and helped get off the ground and helped advise all the way through. Welcome back to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's so exciting to be back with this group, with all three of y'all, and just to see everything that has happened in the last 2.5 years of just everything that y'all have accomplished. It's really exciting to see it from the sidelines and to be back here with you is a gift. So thank you for having me back.
And yes, go Blue.
We are thrilled to have you back. And just for the Michigan fans out there, I just want to also underline, he is wearing blue today. So he like means it when he says go Blue. But I'm really stoked to have you here. And Gabe, I'm still in a celebratory mood. And so I got to say, not only are you a co-host, but like really, really officially in this moment, a master of sacred music. How's it going? Canto, not yet cantor, but canto, Gabe Snyder.
I'm doing great. I'm really excited to have that degree and that pink hood. More excited for, you know, 362 days from now, but who's counting? Even more than that, I'm so excited and so proud of my friend, my rabbi, Rabbi Amanda Catherine Weiss. How you doing, Rabbi?
I'm thrilled. And I do want to let the listeners know that when this episode gets released, it'll be even closer to his ordination. So like, he'll be even more excited at that point in time. I was going to make a joke about whether or not Gabe thought he put the canto in Encanto, which would have made Hudson like very excited because she can't actually say Encanto. She just goes canto, which makes it really, really cute. But you know, that would have taken too long out of our episode. So I definitely wouldn't have ever done such a thing. But just in case I did, hello, executive producer Edon Valdman. We're thrilled you're here and definitely not at all distracted by all of my, you know, pathwinding intros along the way. How's it going, Edon? And I think you had a celebration of your own recently, haven't you?
Yes, though that kind of makes it sound like it's something completely unrelated. But actually, my wife, good friend of everybody here, Agnes Beryl Valdman, has also been ordained as a cantor yesterday as well.
Yay, Agnes!
We are all just so excited.
Edon, does that make you a Chazansin?
We've joked over the years that this would make me a Chazanta.
Chazanta. Okay, very good.
If you aren't familiar with the Chazantas, you should look them up. That and it will make that contextually funnier.
We'll have something in the show notes for you. I love it. I am so excited to be, I think, both in celebration and in reflection with everyone here today. We are really going to talk about Bamidbar. By the way, I do like our penultimate podcast episode is a portion that all of us argue about how to pronounce. Is it Bamidbar? Is it Bamidbar? Is it Bamidbar? And of course, as Edon Valdman reminded me, it's also just a throwback because it was his bar mitzvah portion. So, or is it your bar mitzvah portion? And so like, you know, it's a tricky thing, but we're going to get into it. Not really. We're going to get into a real conversation right now. Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
I think I might just sit this episode out.
No. This is our second to last episode. You have to be here. Also, like, Edon and I are not good at timing. Remember that cheese episode?
I mean, but hear me out. Like, I don't count in this portion, right? So, like, do I necessarily need to be here?
Okay. Even though you don't count in this portion, you totally count as a person and as a rabbi. So, like, yes, you do need to be here.
Okay, so maybe even though I was just newly ordained, that's why I don't fully know what this portion's about. So can you clue me in so I don't sound silly?
All right. Welcome to Parashat Bamidbar. God commands Moses to take a census. Why? So we know how many fighters we have, all men over age 20 who are able to fight. There will be people from each tribe who will help, and they're listed, but we don't need to get into that because there's a lot of them and names are hard to do this quickly. So Moses and Aaron do the count, and there's a lot of people, 603,550 to be exact, plus all the elderly men and women and children, plus the Levites who weren't counted because they need to attend to the Mishkan stuff, so they're not fighting. Then we learn how to set up the camp, all the tribes around the tent of meeting. There are more specifics about who's next to who, but again, we don't need to get into that. Next, we count the Levites and name their responsibilities. Basically, one, serve God. Two, serve the high priest. End list. Then there's another census. We love counting. We count all the firstborn males. Why? So we can tax them. And just how many are there? 22,273. Cool. Oh, by the way, the Levites have a subclan within the tribe called the Kohathites. They're in charge of the most sacred stuff, like the curtain and the cover on the ark, and those weird dolphin skins and the blue cloths and the bowls and the ladles and the jars and the jugs and bread and crimson cloth and more dolphin skin because reasons. Who's in charge of the oil and the incense and the offerings and the tabernacle and everything consecrated within it? Eleazar, son of Aaron. Then God warns Moses and Aaron to take care of the Kohathites, but they can't go into the sanctuary. The punishment, spoiler alert, it's death. And that's Parashat Bemidbar.
Nice. Well done.
Thank you. I think that is the only time I've ever done that in one take, and I'm pretty proud of it. So good job, Gabe.
Andrew, I'm really thrilled to be celebrating with you in this way, but also to welcome you back and to be reflecting and reflective even on some of the work that you do and some of the work that we've done together. And I feel like I've really been influenced by the work that you've done with HEC and have been really lucky to get to be with you during this time. And so for people who may not know, what insights, beliefs really help drive your work and the support that you give students these days? Why is that important?
Yeah. Well, I might be saying things that I've said ago, like the first time I was on the podcast, but that was a long time ago. And in all fairness, I think my role has shifted significantly, both functionally, because, you know, we are still dealing with the after effects of the pandemic. And what does that mean? And we're dealing with, I actually think that last time I was here, I was part-time, and now I'm full-time in the role of director of student support. So maybe it's not redundant. So my philosophy of how I approach my work, and this was the case back when I was working with homebound seniors, with military, in congregations, basically in every facet, every time I find myself doing work, it's always about the people I'm working with. The content matters, but only as a way of making sure that the individuals who are there feel bought in, right? They feel excited. They feel connected to the content. And without that human element, we lose the content, right? If you're not making, and I think that's what this podcast does so brilliantly, is if you're not making it relevant and immediate, it feels archaic. It feels out of touch. And then all of a sudden, it doesn't actually help people. It doesn't instruct them. So my approach has always been, I believe in education as an industry deeply. I love anything that has like a growth framework, the idea that people grow and change. I love that. I love that. I feel like people grow and change all the time. And I love an industry that really supports that. But it's all about the people. And so often in our institutions, definitely historic Jewish institutions, but pretty much any like North American institution, it's so much focused on the mainstream, right? Like in our Parsha, right? The 20 and older able-bodied men, like it focuses on that. And my philosophy is really trying to make sure that everyone who is part of, in this case, the school, anyone who is part of our group feels it. And that actually is a different approach than most typical institutions, right? There's a sense of, this is what we do. And if you don't fit in, try to fit in. And so that's really the approach I do when I am doing student support, is trying to say, what are we doing that is either structurally or interpersonally? What are we doing that is potentially a stumbling block? What are we doing that's not helping individuals? What are we doing that's not helping all individuals? What are we doing that is just sort of reinforcing all of the old tropes? And then the flip side is, what are we doing that actually is including people? Like, what are we doing that is taking into account everything that we have learned in the last 3 years, 33 years, 133 years, right? As we continue to learn and grow, why not incorporate that? And especially a lot of my work focuses on disability accommodations as one, I think, very clear a manifestation of a supportive student environment, is wanting to make sure that people who have some hurdles, that we are trying to reduce that hurdle, that individuals can really function in an equitable educational environment. And there's been a lot of work of like creative education and different ways to accommodate disabilities and technological improvements. And so it's really like wanting to use all of that to just help people be successful, because it's all about people, right? It's like, if you go out into the world and you're serving a congregation, or we have a cantor who is, you know, doing like amazing units at a camp, and we have organizational leaders who are just out there impacting the world, none of that matters if they don't feel valued and if they don't help other people feel valued and feel welcome. So it really is this like hopefully wonderful cycle where people who feel welcome want to go out there and help other people feel welcome. So that's my philosophy. And it actually dovetails perfectly with this Torah portion, which is also really exciting. And as an aside, I'm a rabbi, so I can make anything dovetail with anything. But I do see a lot here that's really focused on the importance of the people in our midst.
You know, I definitely see that there's like an importance of people in our midst within this Torah portion. And I definitely hear what you're saying about making sure that, unlike in this Torah portion, that like really everybody counts, that, you know, as a 20-something generally able-bodied man, I would be counted and I have a role and I know what that role is. And also, there are a lot of people who do not fit into that category in our communities today. The majority of the people ordained at HUC New York this past week were not men. There were several women. There were the first three non-binary clergy people, cantors, to be ordained, which was very exciting for everybody. And it's really wonderful to hear you talk about, you know, making sure that people count, making sure that their voice is heard, making sure that we hear and count that whole community. It does occur to me, though, that counting the whole community feels distant. Assigning people numbers feels distant, especially because Moses and Aaron, who are told to do this thing, then delegate out to people within the tribes to count their own tribes and report back. And then they get the separate numbers and then we add them up. And then there are the separate counts for the firstborn children and for the Levites. And all of it feels very distant. And one of the things that occurs to me is that one of the ways in which your role has changed since you were last here is that we've shifted from Zoom school back to in-person. And so I would imagine that being physically at a distance, being on Zoom, has a very different role in terms of accommodations, in terms of being there for students, in terms of making sure that people count, as opposed to being in person. How do we make sure that we count everybody, that we're really responding to those needs, even when we're at that distance? How do we make sure that even when we're trying to count everybody, and you know, when there are 600,000 people, you can't count every single person by hand, how do we make sure that we're still honoring each individual?
It's a fantastic question. So I'm going to start the answer as a small side path, and then I'll come back to the answer. And if I forget the question, I might ask you to remind me. Yes, I think the distance is real. I also want to note, and I think you've already said it explicitly, but just to say it again, that this Torah portion does try to count everyone. But who the everyone is in fact not counting everyone, right? And just to say that, you know, we're enumerating every able-bodied man over 20, and along with it, they say, and the elderly, and the women, and. The purpose of this count was really trying to figure out who could serve in the army. So for me, I see this as actually a big symbolic shift from in the past really caring a lot about only like major players and thinking about those individuals who count. And that is actually, you know, women and men, adults and kids, and also really focusing on resources, right? So we hear a lot about dolphin skins in previous passages and all of the stones and the gold and the other, you know, materials. It's so important in the construction of the tabernacle. And all of the ritual objects, it's so important that focus on materials. And while, as you said earlier, Gabe, there is some of that here, this is a really big shift from saying, you know, if you have lapis and dolphin skins and gold and, and to focusing on the humans, the individuals there. So while this does elide certain people, I don't want to undersell that. That is really important. But here, I actually think it gives us an opportunity to even focus on more people, right? So that's where my brain goes while I'm reading this. They're really just trying to come up with a census of who could be fighting in the army. And along with that, I always ask the question of, well, who else was there, right? Who else would have been there, making sure that the tent doesn't fall apart, or that this moving metropolis, as they're like wandering through the desert, that it doesn't fall apart. And there's a whole society that's not touched on here, but is very clearly there. So for me, that distance is real. And also, I insert it not for any sort of political reason, which I also could do, but I insert it because you know they're there. They mention that they are there, right? So I think that they count in terms of how the community is structured. They're not enumerated. They don't count as part of the count of army folk. I make that distinction because it's really easy to think about who's in and who's out. And this goes to your question, Gabe, and hopefully I remember it. And if not, you can remind me that I didn't answer it right. But I think that, you know, there's this opportunity to either be really narrow in how we think about who belongs, who's in. And, you know, with the example of Zoom, to think about who's in the classroom as being primary and those on the screen are secondary, right? That is something that has been a trope of hybrid education actually for a while, is that when there are some in person and some on the screen, that doesn't feel equitable. I will say that COVID gave us the chance to start thinking differently about a classroom out of necessity. I think everyone, students and faculty, were kind of kicking and screaming because having to sit behind a computer in the same chair for like 9 hours a day for an entire year, like that's brutal. And it's also educationally, it's not as dynamic. It's not as exciting. You don't have the conversations that happen the second the class is done, but everyone's still churning with all that exciting stuff and people keep those conversations going. But what it did do was it allowed us to think about how we can, I think, bring more equity in to a system that really had been off balance. So prior to the pandemic, I had students who, for a variety of different medical conditions, sometimes found it difficult to come into the classroom, right? That could be pregnancy or right after giving birth. That could be physical mobility challenges or being immunosuppressed. There's so many different reasons why someone might not feel comfortable or be physically able to show up in person. And prior to the pandemic, that person either had to push themselves, sometimes medically unsafe, or miss class. And what I do think is nice is that, and it's not been easy, and I don't think it's been across the board, but it has given us that opportunity for faculty and administrators and students to think about how we access and just having multiple access points in theory, and the fact that that does widen who's in, right? Who's in and who's out. And so not to be cynical, right? We could easily count who's in the classroom, butts in the seat. But when we start thinking about the fact that we could be studying with colleagues across the country, we can start thinking about, like, you don't have to put yourself in physical danger or like spend all your spoons to get to class and then be depleted for the rest of the weekend, or cause a worse medical issue because of it. Like, this all of a sudden actually, I think, makes our community a lot more, and actually makes who counts and how we can count them more. The technology was sort of the pivot point, but really what changed was the mentality of individuals at school and really across the whole higher ed industry during the pandemic, of how we think about our people. And again, it goes back to really focusing on the people of it all and not just the content. And that is really encouraging for me. What this all means down the line in 5-10 years, when God willing, like, we're not in like pandemic crisis mode and we're back to like, you know, people existing in a way that's not like plagued by angst, but we'll see how long it can last and what it actually means. But I'm hopeful, but I'm also an annoying optimist, and I just want to name that. And there's space to push back because there's an annoying nature of this where it can, in fact, sort of diminish those who are more marginal by saying, look, can't we all just get along and look how great this is? And I'm aware of my own penchant towards that. And I really do believe it. I really do believe that there's been a lot, and it's not me, right? I feel lucky that I get to be in this seat as we're doing it as an institution, but I feel lucky that there has been a shift in how we think about the humans who happen to be students studying to be rabbis, and their entire identity is not reduced to a career path or to a degree. Their entire humanity is brought in as a holistic sense of self. And we are aware that psychological, emotional, social, personal, all of that exists. And I actually think we do a much better job when we are aware of the whole person.
I want to say thank you to that. And I think that I might be able to square the circle, right? To say that you might be an annoying optimist, who knows? I will say, I really appreciate your emphasis, highlight, underline, exclamation point, bold, of really seeing the person, because I do think that ties in to our Torah portion, and I'm gonna get there, but I'm gonna walk us back a little bit. So here's the deal: we talked to you about Genesis, you know, your first one. We're in Numbers with you now. I'm skipping Leviticus, ish. Sorry, but I'm gonna take you to Exodus for a quick sec, which is to say, you know, when we started thinking about ourselves as a people, the first time we were called a people, the first time we were called Bnei Yisrael, right, is in Exodus by Pharaoh, who was so anxious that this Bnei Yisrael was going to swarm, you know, was going to be huge and was going to just be so numerous that the Egyptians wouldn't be able to handle it. And then we get to this place in Numbers where we talk about tribes and we talk about numbers and math, and numbers are too high for me to count on both my hands and toes. I'm almost positive, you know, but we get to this place where people are very numerous and we're trying to have a system, and we talk about maybe who's counted and who's missed out on. And there is a piece that I think is really kind of cool here, if depending on how you want to read it, that says, like, when we're able to see the people for who they are, right? And in Numbers 2:2, for those that are following along for at home, you know, there's a line that says, Ish al diglo be'otot, right? Lebeitz avotam short. But, like, before you get there, you get Ish al diglo be'otot, that you have each person with their flag, with their standard, with their banner. And there is something that matters, right, about this idea of each person is standing with their flag that represents who they are. And that's special. And I think that that speaks to your point before about seeing people, the person, for who they are, and not necessarily seeing people for a swarm. Here's my question, and I'm going to throw this out there, that the numbers are large. The numbers are large. And for a person like me who's about to go to a synagogue with 670 families, for the director of student support who is overseeing people at four different campuses internationally, plus, by the way, all of the alumni that like create relationships and supporting people when they leave, you know, what happens or how can we best support when the numbers might start to get a little beyond us, right? We are one person. It's not good to do this alone, you know, with Yitro. But I'm thinking about this idea of it's so important for us to see the whole person. And also, if we believe the understanding that, you know, each human is only really capable with holding strongly onto a maximum of 180, I think, relationships, right? What do we do to see the whole person, to support them, to love them, you know, when the numbers start to get beyond us?
It's a wonderful question. And it is something that I thought a lot about. I've played in organizational change and organizational dynamics quite a lot. And it's part of what I like to do in my professional world of getting to create something, right? And so first director of student support at HUC, first campus rabbi at the University of Richmond, getting to create something, it's really exciting. You get to sort of like birth a program baby. That's a terrible phrase. I apologize for that. But you get to sort of create something that you see is necessary. And you are, by definition, putting something into a culture that had likely been in homeostasis prior, right? So this culture, wherever you're putting it in, right? So HUC was functional for almost 150 years, and it still is functional. I don't mean to say it, right? Like, but it existed for almost 150 years without the director of student support. So the question is, like, how do you make sure that people see the value proposition? How do you see, like, all that kind of stuff? But really, I think it comes down to respecting the people, right? So then you're, like, thinking about the people who are there and the culture that they live in and wanting to be deferential to that reality and working with individuals to help move the needle towards where you want it to go. And I think that that has been a really important part of the work I do, is not just coming in and saying everyone should do it this way, because in our four campuses, that's not possible, right? Like they're based in four very different, at least four, right? Each campus has multiple cultures anyway, but it has at least four different like cultural realities that they're steeped in. And to come in and to just try to push it through is not going to be successful. So I say that because that sense of belonging and identity and being part of a unique culture as part of a clan, I actually think is a really important thing to retain. What I like about this Torah portion that actually maps it out for us is God is deputizing Moses to do this counting, or assigning Moses. I don't know if God's deputizing Moses. That's a fun little aside, we could have that conversation. But God's assigning Moses. Moses is assigning the chieftains. The chieftains are then going through, right? So there's a clear sense of deputization to make sure that there's a real sense of knowledge of the institution. I actually think one of the ways that this works is exactly the opposite of why the prophets have such a hard time, right? They come into cultures that exist as outsiders, and they're trying to like push people to do different, but it's hard work. And there's something about having an insider who's there, who's trusted, who's seen as part of the group, and more important, sees those in the group as part of them, that then it becomes a really important piece. So to answer your question, Amanda, again, this is why you don't hand rabbis microphones. To answer your question, I think what we can do, and this was actually something that Synagogue 2000 used to do a lot of, and you can, there's a lot of other pieces too, but like the Synagogue 2000 had this idea that you grow bigger by growing smaller. And I love it because that's what we see here, right? We have this stupid big multitude of masses that are part of this, and like the number is inconceivable. And that's only able-bodied men over 20, right? So like we're thinking it's like a really big number, but the way that they're able to retain this sense of identity is dafka by having like sub-identities, right? Affinity groups, having different and respecting the cultures that exist. And instead of trying to like dismiss the differences, in fact, embracing them. So like the Naphtali tribe and standing near their flag, right? That's its own discrete group. And by valuing that and saying, you Naphtalians are, you know, you are a unique group. And I would love to sort of like understand what your needs are, what your numbers are, what your people are looking for, right? That kind of thing. So that would be my suggestion, I think, to anyone who's working in the world, right? Whether it is you are working in one classroom or you're working as an administrator looking over multiple classrooms, you're working in a congregation with multiple constituent groups and different demographics. But practically, it's the same, which is the people matter. And the more that the people understand that you believe they matter, and it's not just saying it, it's like really believing it deep down that none of this exists without our people, once you can say like the people matter and there's, you know, and this group of like early childhood center parents need something different. They believe something different. They feel something different. They identify as something different than the empty nesters. And let's create a space where both of them can feel valued and part of this community. So that's my, you know, that's the way I think about it. And again, that's, I feel like something that I've tried to do at HUC to the extent that it's possible and to the extent that it's successful. Like, I'll let our students weigh in on that. Not you all. Like, well, we don't need to bring this in as a referendum right now. But I think this idea of really creating that space where everyone can hopefully feel like they belong, they matter.
Well, I just want to say that you matter and you count. And as much as we have learned today, don't give rabbis microphones, we do really appreciate your advice and your leadership and your guidance throughout this entire process of the podcast project experiment thing. You've really been either by our side closely or, you know, we always knew we could call on you. And I just want to name that and say we really appreciate it. We also want to, you know, share you with the wider world, which is why you've come on this podcast for the second time. Amanda doesn't want to share you. I think you deserve to be shared with the wider world. And so usually we ask our guests if they had one message, one call to action, one piece of wisdom they wanted to share. But we're going to let you just say what you want. So maybe if you have like 1 to 3 messages, calls to action, pieces of wisdom, what do you want listeners to walk away with after hearing this episode and, you know, listening to the last few years of this podcast?
Yeah, I mean, having one is an open-ended question that's overwhelming. Needing to come up with upwards of 3 is really a lot. First of all, thank you so much. This, hopefully, having heard this last little bit, right, shouldn't come as a surprise to the listeners that getting to support students when they have an awesome idea, when they have passions, when they have struggles, whatever it is, getting to support students is my way of looking in the world, right? And it's obviously doesn't have to be just students, getting to support people, right? Seeing people for who they are, wanting to hear, genuinely hear from them and genuinely respond, you know, appropriately. That is my default. So getting to be here and in any way supporting y'all is like, it's a win-win, right? Like, you all get to do something you're passionate about, and the world gets this like awesome podcast, and it really is deeply gratifying. So I guess that would be part of the first suggestion, recommendation, message. I don't know what the right word is. I'll say message or thing. Everything else feels really maybe a little too grandiose. But I think, and as it feels so obvious, I mean, this is why I loved studying psychology. I don't know if you feel the same, Amanda, but what I loved about studying psychology was that it takes these intuitive things and puts fancy names on them, right? So you talk about pro-social behavior and altruism and all this stuff, and these are wonderful concepts that ultimately are like, people want to help people, right? Like, it's just so obvious. And yet, so that's where I'm at, right? Which is, this is so intuitive to me, but I understand, obviously, it's not in the world because we have a lot of people not being supported. But for me, it's like really taking the time to look at the person you're talking to and thinking about, you know, the whole person there. It can be like these trite aphorisms of like, think about what it's like for them. Everyone has a world you're not aware of that they're carrying around with them, right? Like all these things that are so true, even though they're packaged as these like Dove chocolate bar quotes, but still they're really important. And that's what I would suggest is that, you know, to when you're sitting down and talking with someone, to really look at them and look at their smile and look at the emotion that's existing in their eyes and the tone of their voice as they're sharing, because, you know, beyond the words, there's a whole world of emotional reality that's there. And I believe, I actually heard the statistic that I won't be able to support, and hopefully no one fact checks this, but there's something like, if you look at someone for 5 minutes or something like that, if you actually look at someone for 5 minutes, you rate them, individuals rate them as more attractive, as more likable. There's something about just connecting with someone that bridges distance. And so that's, you know, my number one is just like when you're sitting with someone, believing them and valuing them and trusting them and like feeling honored that you get to be with them. And when you have that idea, all of the sudden what they're sharing is not this like random concern or this random, it's actually something that matters deeply to them and matters deeply to me. First thing. Second thing that I have always tried to do is I think of our students as colleagues in a bit, right? Like they're colleagues, they care deeply. They are spending their entire like time and energy and lack of sleep and everything to try to move through these programs to develop as a Jewish professional because they care so deeply that they want to do it. At the point of admissions, even like when you first, when a, someone first contacts the admissions department all the way through graduation and ordination, we're working with individuals who care so much that they want to devote their life to this. So where I'm sitting, these are my people, right? It's like a bunch of, and I mean this in no disparaging, like a bunch of nerdy people who want to study Judaism, want to understand history, want to make it relevant, and want to go out there and make a difference. And so treating our students as partners in the work that we've tried to do, who happen to be earlier on in their career, who happen to be in the midst of their studies, but treating them as partners, as opposed to really embracing the hierarchical nature of the higher ed world, where you have administrators who sit above students in terms of power and access and all that stuff. And that for me is really important, right? Is that when I talk to kids, and I'm talking, like, I mean, actual kids, when I'm working with students, when I'm working with seniors in the community, I don't ever think of myself as a rabbi because that's not the, I mean, I guess I do, but like, I never hold myself up as a rabbi. I never like act like a rabbi. I never feel like I comport myself that way because for me, it's really sitting down with someone with whom I share a lot. And I actually, one of my, I don't want to say games, but like one of my favorite things to do is really getting to understand where all the shared interests are, right? So someone mentions that they love graphic novels, or someone loves opera, or someone loves Bitcoin, whatever it is. I actually know nothing about Bitcoin or crypto, and actually that's a bad example. But whatever it is trying to find that connection. And once you feel a connection with someone, all of a sudden, they're an insider in a different way. And I think that's really important. The last thing I'll say is that, which goes very opposite to this Torah portion, is the 20 plus year old able-bodied men, they count in our Torah, they count. They count in many societies, not just like ancient biblical society, but they count. Where I put my attention is the places and the people that are not as obvious and or not as historically, those who don't count as much historically, right? Who should count as much, but haven't, you know, historically counted as much. And so I find I like to spend my time and energy supporting those who have had fewer historical institutional supports, both because often they need it, and often institutions are biased against it. And also because that's where I feel like you can, you meet people with very different stories, the less typical story. I joke, and I don't mean this in any negative way, of like, thing, you know, a 20-something from Brandeis. That's great. We need those people. That's wonderful, right? People who come in with a Near Eastern Jewish studies background, passionate about Judaism, locked into the Reform world. Like, that is really great and important. It's the person who went to an engineering school, or the person who went to a design school. It's the person who went, who has navigated multiple intersectional identities that maybe has given them access to different social and cultural realities. Like, that's really interesting. And I think, you know, if we look at the Talmud, which doesn't say, here's the rule, full stop, there's a reason why it takes 63 volumes over multiple bookshelves to have the Talmud, because in fact, we value and we raise up different perspectives. And that the Talmud, that sort of the dialogic nature of Talmud, tries to bring multiple perspectives to bear. And I think that it's been really far too long that, I'll just limit it to Jewish society, that sort of the North American Jewish experience has been very much focused on, you know, cisgender, hetero, able-bodied, Ashkenazi folks. And I think we have lost a lot by limiting, by only counting those folks, right? Think about what this Torah portion would have looked like. It would have been so much longer than it already is, but think about what it would have looked like if instead of just saying, here are these people who are ready to go off to war, if we added in the stories of the people who were going to stay home from war and added in some of the other elements that were part of the world, and just think about how much richer, how much more dynamic and more relatable and affirming and inclusive that would be. So those are my big three, right? And that was a really long monologue, and I apologize to our listeners, but those are my big three. And that's like really what pushes me to get out of bed every morning and do the work I do, is because I believe in that so deeply. And I believe that HUC cares and uses the support, or I guess wants the support that I can give to make sure that we really embody that for our students. And that's what I'm, you know, teaching my own children. And that's the type of stuff that we're trying to do, is just realizing that we're all just humans and we're all just trying our hardest. And by valuing that in others, I think it actually can connect us all, period.
We're both beginning and ending this penultimate podcast episode with a new book and its primary parasha, Bamidbar, which kicks us off with how we best think about what counts. In this particular portion, you're counted if you're considered an eligible adult male. And so for today's Midrashic mixology for Parashat Bamidbar, emphasis on the bar, which for anybody counting is the second time I've offered a recipe to this incredible guest, is entitled for our beloved backstage advisor, and we bring you a good man. Take a census of the ingredients in your home. Decide you need a feeling of support. Take a deep breath because you know that your actions will be recorded for posterity for years to come. In a shaker, combine 2 ounces of a strong whiskey, symbolizing the Israelites' strength and resilience on their journey. 1 ounce of freshly squeezed orange juice for the sweet and tart surprises that might come up along the way. 1 ounce, that's 6 teaspoons, of honey syrup as a nod to the land of milk and honey that we're striving toward. And 1 dash of bitters, because, well, y'all know moving through the land was not easy. Fill the shaker with ice and shake until well chilled. For those who don't know what honey syrup is, don't worry, it's just 1 part honey to 1 part water, stirred until fully dissolved. Pro tip, shake it up in a mason jar, no cleanup needed, and it's already in a nice sealed container. Strain the cocktail into a highball glass filled with ice, and then top the glass with soda water as a refreshing reminder of the water that God provided for the Israelites during their 40-year excursion. Garnish with an orange slice as a colorful wink to the future they'll find. For a non-alcoholic good man, because we want to ensure that our numbers come out correctly, replace the whiskey with equal parts apple juice and cranberry juice. P.S. Surprise math thing. 2 ounces of whiskey, 1 ounce orange juice, 6 teaspoons syrup, 1 dash of bitters, 1 splash of soda water, and 1 orange wedge makes 12 for the 12 tribes. Cool math, Gabe. Either way, remember that whenever somebody says, I'll never use math, they're probably wrong. And that's as good a reason as any to say, L'chaim.
Yum. That sounds delicious.
I'm glad you like it.
And I'm a big fan of honey in drinks. I make a Jewish communitini, which is apple liqueur, honey liqueur, and vodka. and it tastes like apples and honey, and it is quite good. So I feel like it's evocative of the honey, and it sounds real good.
Well, I'm glad you like this one. It literally has your name on it. You know, I'm really glad that we get to give two drinks to our listeners today. And who knows, maybe with your permission, we'll record your Jewish communitini in our future cookbook that we really hope happens someday. That's an aspirational thing, but still fun.
Amen.
So when I first took the GRE, which was the graduate requirement exam or something along those lines for HUC, I really had to study, you know, especially for the math part. And when I got my score, which they give you as soon as you finish it on the computer, by the way, it literally like flashes up at you. I got very confused because my math score was higher than my verbal score, and I didn't know that that was possible. And I was very, very confused because I had to do the math several times because the score was higher than I had done, you know, at any time. And so it was a really interesting place to kind of be like, wow, what do I do with this math section, you know, when I'm trying to go into rabbinic school? And the answer was, I guess it worked out well because I went to rabbinical school. But what I will say is that timing and math is always tricky for me. And so I'm sad that we've gotten to the last penultimate section of our penultimate podcast recording. But we are at our thank yous and closing cues. And so today, even though, you know, we have talked a lot about what counts and who counts and maybe even how to count, the question still stands, Andrew, Gabe, and Edan. How do numbers impact or influence or fit in to your Judaism? Andrew, we'll start with you.
That's such a great question. I have two thoughts. First is, you know, similar to this Torah portion, there's something about sort of making sure that we have accurate data that feels really important. That happens in my work all the time. But thinking about budgets and the numbers of students and what percentage of students have done this or that. And it's so banal. And yet it's so important, right? Because we only know where we're at if we have good data, and good data is all resting on numbers, or at least the data that I play with, right? So in some ways it's such a weird, underwhelming answer, but like, data allows us to, you know, run reports that allow us to see and know whether we're being successful. And so for me, that question of data is really important. The other thing, which is a much more sort of good rabbinic answer, is I was thinking about Echad Miodea, who knows one, and thinking about that song that we sing at the Seder and how really everything from 1 to 13, each number is significant. And I love that idea, right? Similar to like the Ashrei, where every letter is written out, except for Nun, but every letter is written out. And there's something about, you know, the inclusion of each, by noting each part, there's a sense of the bigger whole that comes in. And so for me, 1 through 13, 1 through 613, whatever it is, every number is significant if we want it to be. And I want it to be, right? So then it's really looking at numbers as a vehicle. And by understanding numbers, better understanding history, culture, God, peoplehood, etc.
As someone who loves data, and I can potentially speak to that when it's my turn to answer this question, I think that it's very rabbinic, and I will explain why when it's my turn. But for right now, it is Master of Sacred Music, Gabe Snyder's turn.
So along with this portion, you know, we get this census thing, which is all about counting people. And we still do that in Judaism. We absolutely count people. Not only when we, you know, take congregational censuses, censi, does not matter, but also every time we go into a prayer service, we kind of count the people. We are told that there are certain blessings we can only say if we are in a community that like has a quorum. And what constitutes a quorum? It's called a minyan. It's 10 people. We need 10 people in some circles, only certain people count. In more progressive streams, everybody counts. But you want 10 people. And what I think, and I've talked about this before on the podcast, but one thing that I think is really special is that even though we count, and even though we want to have 10 people, we need 10 people to say certain blessings, we don't assign people numbers. We never count people by pointing and going around the room and saying 1, 2, 3. We don't do that. In one particular tradition that I happen to love, is that you assign the first 10 people a syllable of the first line of the piece of liturgy, Ma Tovu, which is what you're supposed to say as you enter a synagogue or as you enter a sanctuary. And those first 10 syllables, Ma Tovu Ohalecha Yaakov. And so as we're counting the people, we say, how beautiful, how awesome, how great are these tents? How wonderful is it that we can be in this community together? And how wonderful is it that, you know, these people count? So that's kind of my answer, is counting people, but, you know, nobody's just a number, and we want to make sure that everybody counts.
Ma tovu ohalecha Yaakov, how beautiful are your tents, O Jacob, wonderful. And kind of a cool way to just be like, hey, let's learn some Hebrew. Idan, speaking of Hebrew and math and Judaism and all of the things that you're going to talk about in this moment, how do you find numbers, influences, impacts, or is instilled in your Judaism?
Well, I'm sure there are better answers that I could think of if I thought harder for longer. But at this exact moment, the first thing that comes to mind in regards to math and my Judaism is, and I haven't done this in a while, but our listeners probably remember that I have made a very large number of virtual choir videos early in the pandemic, probably the first half of the pandemic. And something that people don't realize is when making those and you are laying out all the people's boxes in the grid, you can't just be like, this many people, this many rows, this many columns, and it just does it. You have to do the math for, okay, if I want to do this many, what percentage of the size of the full video am I resizing it to? What position am I placing it to? How many pixels is that? This is the center of the video. And then, okay, well, if it's not a consistent number, the number of rows and columns aren't the same, then you have to start cropping the videos off and doing the math of how much are you cropping off horizontally. And then that affects the placement values and everything. And it's a ton of math, to the point where I actually bought a notebook that was like a dotted grid as a way of charting out all my math. And I actually really enjoyed it, because as someone who did really well and really enjoyed doing math in school, I don't always have a good excuse to do math. So that was always a fun excuse for that. I really enjoyed doing it, even when sometimes I was getting real stumped as to, okay, but that number should be the right number, but it's not looking right in the video, blah, blah, blah. And so though I haven't done those anytime really recently, that was a huge part of my day-to-day life from late spring 2020 until summer 2021.
I know for a fact that Idan just like helped with videos for some celebratory things recently. So he is too modest, and that is fine. But what I will say is for me, well, I certainly couldn't do that type of math that Idan plays out, although I do like to sketch, so like maybe that'd be fun just to like play and sketch out with. I want to go back to Andrew's point on data, which is that numbers are great for data if they're honest, and numbers and data help us tell a story. Numbers and data help us really with the story of what is it that we're doing? Are we hitting our mission? Are we able to like really be serving people? How are we serving people? But I gotta throw this out there. Numbers are one part of data. They are quantitative part of data. There's also the qualitative part of that data, right? And so it might be that you met 5 people, but if you had like, you know, and you wrote down, I met 5 people, but if you had an hour conversation with one of them and 4 of them were like, hey, how you doing? Good, bye. You know, it's different data. The data is different. You know, the reach is different. The impact is different. And so I think for me, numbers are really beautiful because they help you make a connection to how you're counting. And really focus on that. And I have to tell you, as somebody who has her entire life, and by the way, this doesn't change when you become a clergy person, so just in case you're curious, I'm pretty positive it doesn't, counted the number of pages to the end of a high holiday service in a mass order. You know, like, that numbers also matter that way, like, just in case you're curious. And I don't believe that changes when you are leading the service. Just throwing that out there, but maybe I will learn differently when I start my new job in a few months. Having said all of this, all of these are really room for conversations. And so, Andrew, if people want to continue the conversation with you, how can they best find or follow you?
I used to have a Twitter that was only the songs that got stuck in my head. I don't have that Twitter anymore. It was really awesome, but I think it's been since expunged because it's been a long time. So I basically am not really findable on social media, but my email address is super easy, andrew.goodman@huc. But I think more importantly, you know, if someone is interested in anything that I said, it's part of HUC, right? It's part of a whole institution, and like just so many dedicated administrators and faculty members and alumni and passionate students. And more information about that, huc.edu/explore. And that can give you some insight into what we're doing, why we're doing it, and if you're interested, how you can do important, meaningful stuff that could center around numbers or not.
I love that. And yeah, absolutely. Check out huc.edu as well for any information on the program that Gabe and I are in, and that Edon has been really such a friend to, and I would argue partner of. Like, maybe you're married to a cancer, but I would say, like, really you're everybody's family member at HUC, because we love you, Edon, very, very much. So I think that's exciting. Andrew, we're so grateful to you. And I just want to let you know that, you know, normally we say any last words, thoughts, concerns, or jokes, but like, I'm not going to do that this time. This time I'm just going to say thank you so, so much, Andrew, for every single thing that you have done for us as we've made it through. And really, thank you for looking at me on a school bus one day in the middle of summer 2019 and saying, hey, like, what do you think about making that a podcast? And then when I laughed and came back to you, you know, like a year plus later, not being me, not laughing back at me, you know, and being willing to support the creation of this. And you know, I have to tell you, I'm not sure that either one of us would have thought that 2.5 years later, we'd have almost 25,000 downloads in all over the world and have gotten the entire country to tune in, including Wyoming. Thank you, Wendy Berylson. But I have to tell you, Andrew, we're so lucky to have you. So thank you so much for everything you've done.
Well, first of all, I am incredibly humbled that all of this success is in some way in your mind linked to me is incredibly humbling. What y'all have been able to do over the last 2.5 years is really remarkable. And not just because I'm remarking on it, right? Like, just getting out there and being in front of so many different people, really striving hard to get out and get different voices and bring different people together in conversation, all for the purpose of helping people feel connected. I mean, it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. And the fact that y'all were able to do this while being full-time students and trying to have a personal life and doing all of your work and homework and all that stuff, like, it's really quite impressive. And it is such an honor to be able to be on here again as a speaker, as a guest, and also just to be able to sit in the background and see all of your successes. So really, the biggest mazel tov to the three of y'all for being able to, like, make this happen and believing in it. And it, and again, like, all I did was say, this is worth believing in. And I'm really glad that you were willing to listen.
Absolutely. Gabe, thank you so much for a wonderful rundown and an awesome drink, but mostly because your drink got us two recipes for the, you know, price of one show, which was really exciting. So Andrew, we'll email you to get your recipe and of course give you props in the show notes for it. But we are really, really excited about that. And Edon, all of the work that you did during this pandemic, and I will throw out really quickly, and again, we have one last episode after this is going to be done, but I will say, Edon, this podcast would not exist without you, period. And we'll talk more about that next week, but I am so grateful to everyone here. And I am so grateful to Mike for making us all sound brilliant. Thanks, Mike, our editor, who's been just phenomenal. And thank you to you, our listeners, for kicking off Bamidbar with us, but also just for joining us. We'll have one more episode coming next week, and we have a conclusion coming at you. Just stay tuned. Gabe, I want to say that part of the reason that having Andrew come on, you know, this idea of that being so meaningful to me is that a lot of the things that Andrew espouses and I would say even embodies, internalizes, and just promotes to the world, is this idea of really taking the time to see people and hear people and be with people as they are. And that is not always the easiest thing in the world to do, but it's something that I try really hard to do. And for me, when we started this project, we really wanted to help people, yes, acknowledge who they are and be able to take ownership of their Judaism in their own terms and their own times, but also allow them to like embrace that Judaism as part of who they are and as part of what they might have loved about themselves and to maybe see it in a new light. And so I'm really appreciative that, you know, for this particular episode in Parsha, that we were able to, yes, see the tribe for what it is and the clans for what it is and the school for what it is, but also to have that emphasis on really seeing people for who they are as they are individually as well.
You know, I am looking back on our last 5 years of school together, and one word that keeps coming up again and again at HUC, and it becomes a joke at some point because it's such a buzzword, is transference. That we talk about this word transference, which is when somebody looks at you and instead of just seeing you, projects something, projects either their idea of what a rabbi is supposed to be, or maybe a feeling or a history that they had with their childhood rabbi. And that applies to all fields of work. That's not just rabbis and cantors. That is all people experience transference. And, you know, thinking about what you're saying, seeing people as they truly are, that's a part of not only our work, but a part of, you know, how we walk through the world. Transference is a really natural process. And so, you know, I'm curious how we kind of work against that transference and how we both try to not project either preconceptions or previous experiences onto new people, and also how we make sure we put our best selves forward and we show ourselves as we truly are. I think that's just as difficult to do as seeing somebody else for who they truly are, is to really interact with the world authentically as your full self.
So we invite you to do that this week. I mean, one of the things that we did talk about was each person standing by their flag, really each person having their banner standing above them. And so when you're thinking about the Midbar, and if you're like, oh, this particular episode is not for me because it deals with numbers, think about it this way. What message are you flying above your head? What symbols or what actions or ideas are people seeing when they see you standing there? What reputation are you building? Are you doing a good name for yourself? Are you building in relationships so that you can make this bigger world smaller? We're thrilled to have made our smaller world bigger with all of you. And we're also excited to hear from quite a few people recently how many of us are getting to spend Shabbat together with these episodes. That is such a treasure, and we love it, and we love you. We raise our glass to you, and we hope that you get to enjoy a little bit more time under your flag this week. Shabbat shalom, l'chaim, whenever you're listening.
L'chaim.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Andrew Goodman, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. And I love bourbon.